90.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Stay tuned next for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, Fighting Fake News, we'll be listening to a speech that I gave at Sonoma State University for Social Justice Week in April of 2017. The talk, Critical Media Literacy Education, the Antidote to Fake News, Propaganda, and Censorship in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll be listening to a keynote lecture I was invited to deliver at Sonoma State University's third annual Social Justice Week in April of 2017. The talk focuses on the significance of education and critical thinking skills in order to navigate our increasingly saturated digital world. While noting current definitions of so-called fake news, I go into detail about how fake news is actually nothing new and has a quite long and sordid history, particularly in the guise of propaganda. On today's show, Fighting Fake News, the importance of critical media literacy education in a digital age. Here is that talk.
The focus of the talk this evening is critical media literacy education, the antidote to fake news, media filters, and propaganda in a post-truth world. Let's start here. Does anybody remember last year when the Oxford Dictionaries folks, they pick a word every year, a word that has significant meaning or reflection on things that are going on. And in 2016, guess what the word of the year was? Post-truth. Hyphenated word. See, the word of the year can be hyphenated. Post-truth. And by this, they're saying it's an adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Seemed to be a little bit of that going on last year during the election season, where there was a proliferation of a lot of information coming through particularly social media. And over the last several years, social media platforms have become one of the main places where people go to get information. And we're going to get into this here a little later. But that's not to say that some places like Facebook or Twitter are actually journalistic sources or news sources, because they're not. But yet, when polled, if you take a look at the Pew Research Center, when polling people for where most Americans get their news, most people from the United States get their news, I'm clarifying that, they say that it's a social media platform. We're going to come back to that a few different times here. And so in this climate of post-truth, we encountered this phenomenon. It's not a new one, but we had this new label that crept into social media memes, and it started to get picked up in corporate news outlets, and even major political parties like the Democratic National Committee started sort of running this idea that we live in a culture where fake news has some kind of effect on the outcomes of what's going on with people. So I know I'm talking about several different things right now, and it's going to be that way for a minute, but all these things are going to converge here momentarily. So let's hold on to post-truth. And then with post-truth, we will have emerge fake news. But a big part of how this fake news meme gets rolling and where it goes is it eventually transforms itself into the world of alternative facts. We remember Kellyanne Conway, counsel to President Donald Trump. After the inauguration, when Press Secretary Sean Spicer insisted that it was among the biggest and most attended inaugurations in history, journalists, you know, pesky as they may be with facts, clearly showed that this was a falsehood. And Kellyanne Conway, when trying to sort of skirt the obviousness of the falsehood of these statements, just blurted out that Spicer was referring to alternative facts. Now, to their credit, some in the corporate media, like Chuck Todd, will footnote him, bookmark him. We'll come back to say, roundly criticize him in a minute. But Todd rightfully called her on this and said that there are no such things as alternative facts. What you mean is falsehoods. The alternative to a fact is a fiction. But that didn't stop, right, the use of the term alternative facts. And it hasn't stopped the term fake news either. So post-truth was word of the year. And alternative facts, right, like Orwell's 2 plus 2 equal 5, right, are now upon us. And where do we see alternative facts? Well, we apparently see them in so-called fake news. So notice these concepts are converging. In fact, once Kellyanne Conway blurted out this phrase, alternative facts, veteran CBS journalist Dan Rather, footnote, bookmark him, we can come back to roundly criticize Dan as well. But here's Dan Rather after retirement, who's actually been quite the cheerleader for a fierce and independent free press, one that he kind of didn't really do much to make when he was there. But since retirement, he's been quite a vicious critic of corporate media, and he has spearheaded a lot of free press movements. Here is what Dan Rather had to say about Sean Spicer's press conference and Kellyanne Conway's follow-up comments. Rather said, "These are not normal times. These are extraordinary times. And extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. When you have a spokesperson for the President of the United States wrap up a lie in the Orwellian phrase, alternative facts, when you have a press secretary in his first appearance before the White House reporters threaten, bully, lie, and then walk out of the briefing room without the cojones to answer a single question, facts and the truth are not partisan," Rather went on to say. "They are the bedrock of our democracy, and you are either with them, with us, with our Constitution, our history, and the future of our nation, or you're against it." Might be paraphrasing George W. Bush there a little bit, "with us or against us." But Rather said everybody must answer this question. And what he's getting at is he's suggesting that we can't live in a world where people pretend to have alternative facts as reasonable means by which to support their positions. Mark Twain had an interesting way of putting that kind of a sentiment, where he said, "Get your facts first, then you can distort them as much as you please." You can twist them, you can spin them. As the late senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, once said, "We're all entitled to our own opinions, we're not entitled to our own facts." That means no alternative facts. So this is how we kind of get into early this year, and we're still dealing a lot with the phenomenon of fake news, alternative facts in a post-truth world. But let's back up a minute. Let's back up a minute and take a look at sort of a history of some of this kind of affair. It's not new. I've been doing a lot of talks on this subject lately, from Los Angeles to up in Ashland. I was just in Sacramento at the Journalism Association Community College Conference. I've been getting a lot of phone calls, and we've been getting a lot of requests for interviews. So we can at least say that in this last year, the way things have gone, suddenly people are starting to turn on to this idea that we live in a world that is addled with deception and falsehoods. The way that I've actually been describing it more broadly recently is I think that where we are right about now is in the throes of an epistemological crisis, where we live in a society where people have a very hard time discerning fact from fiction, or fact from opinion, alternative fact from actual fact. And this isn't new either. All almost a decade ago, Peter Phillips and I and others at Project Censored, we said that we were living in a truth emergency, that we lived in a society where we were awash in a sea of information, in a digital age where we have so much information at our fingertips, yet we have a paucity of understanding about what it means, where we lack the ability to connect the dots. And of course, over the period of the late 20th century, we were taught that we were supposed to trust professors or experts or journalists and others to try to help us sort that out. And if you go back in the 20th century, we found, you know, there were definitely stalwart characters, whether it's Ida Tarbell or Molly Ivins, if it's Lincoln Steffens or George Seldes, right, who said in the mid-20th century, the job of journalists is to tell people what's actually going on, so they can understand it in a way that's meaningful for them to participate in a representative democratic republic. You can put aerial quotes around that if you want. We can come back to that later. So this issue of establishing information integrity is ongoing. It's a long one. But the current crisis we're in didn't just come out of nowhere. And, of course, at Project Censored, we've been noticing problems with the news media and censorship and propaganda and junk food news, sensationalist, titillating distraction, and so forth for 40 years. So, again, all of a sudden, now when we see a heightened sense of awareness and interest in the public, the Pew poll, recent Pew poll, suggested that roughly 60% of the American public believes that fake news is a crisis. It's a real problem. So, again, hold on to those numbers, because we're eventually, after we outline the history of the development of these problems, we're going to spend some time on what have been the recent solutions proposed, what do I think is wrong with those solutions, and what solution do we propose, at least in addition to, if not outright instead, of the proposed solutions to combating fake news. Well, I already gave the answer away in the title of the talk, so spoiler alert there. Nevertheless, about 10 years ago, I mentioned we coined this term truth emergency, but the term fake news was floating around 10 years ago in the popular culture, and you probably know where. It was on Comedy Central with Stephen Colbert and the Colbert Report, where satire sort of took on this label of fake news, but it was done in a way that was fairly obvious, at least to some, that the purpose was to lampoon the nature of corporate media and commentators and opinion journalism, which had basically taken over through Fox and MSNBC and so forth. But fake news, if you really want to go back and take a look at fake news, this is the problem that we face currently with these issues, is that there are so many iterations and definitions of it floating around. And equivocation is a problem with it, because what happens when the Democratic National Committee started floating fake news last spring and last summer, and they were worried about news stories on social media potentially influencing the outcome of the election after they helped cheat in the primary and have Hillary, sorry about that, Freudian slip, came out. After this took place, and November comes around, and the Democrats find themselves 3 million votes ahead and still losing because of the Electoral College. We'll footnote that. This is not going to turn into a talk about the Electoral College either. But a lot of people began looking around, because the so-called experts that we've been trained to trust, they all kind of looked at each other and they said, what happened? How were we all wrong? Right? Whether it was Nate Silver and his magic numbers, or the DNC chair and the establishment. I mean, they were so confident that they were winning. Let's remember that they did win the popular vote, please. But they were so confident that they didn't even bother to go and campaign in a lot of the Rust Belt states, where things were, well, close enough to tip. And so, November of last year, the fake news meme kind of blew up. And the Democratic Party said, we know that fake news is involved in helping tip the election. These teenagers in Macedonia were pumping out a bunch of fake news for money. And Putin was helping through WikiLeaks. Never mind what WikiLeaks was leaking, or actual emails from John Podesta that proved the rank corruption of the Democrats and the Clinton campaign. Put that aside. But we're supposed to be focusing on how fake news is this big problem that's capable of tipping the outcome of elections, right? And again, all the while, Peter and I and other folks at Project Censored and people that kind of study and follow media and propaganda history are kind of looking around and seeing like, yeah, there's definitely a lot of fake news going on, but this has been going on forever. I'm not sure we're all talking about the same thing. So what happened, as you know, with the fake news meme is that Washington Post started picking it up, and the sort of Democratic establishment and the corporate press were all kind of trying to figure out, well, you know, social media is kind of responsible for letting this genie out of the bottle. And so there was this great focus on how social media was responsible for fake news. Remember what we just said about social media a little bit ago about not being a news platform in the first place? I don't know. I guess you can stretch the definition of fake news as much as you need. But Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, his initial reaction to the finger pointing coming at him, he kind of laughed it off and said, Facebook, man, people post pictures of kittens and things like that, and you're telling me that we tip the balance of the election. We're not a news platform. Well, apparently the PR handlers over at Facebook kind of reeled him in and said, hey, Mark, these people are angry, and they have a lot of money, and they think that you're not taking seriously your role in society in terms of how information now flows through social media, and it's not vetted and or fact-checked. And so what are you going to do about that? And so Zuckerberg said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If fact-checking is the solution to this problem, we'll hire some fact-checkers. And then it was Snopes and PolitiFact, even ABC News, and their fact-checking division was called on board, even though the PolitiFact had found some 40% of their coverage false in certain stories. But we'll forget about that riff there. But Snopes and PolitiFact, did anybody read those? Anybody go there and read those? No? Nobody? They're useful tools for pointing out some things that that should get us thinking. But the real insidious component of places like Snopes and PolitiFact is that people go there as like it's a one-stop shop, and they're like, Snopes said it's bogus. Click, off, done, move along. And they don't ask other questions, and they don't do their own research, and they're not really thinking critically. They're outsourcing this key component of news consumption. That's critical thinking. Thinking about it, asking questions about it, looking at the sourcing, the dates, the bylines, all these things. So from the PolitiFact and Snopes kind of episode, the Washington Post ran an article by Craig Timberg, a former national security editor, who out of the blue propped up this website called Prop or Not, which stood for Propaganda or Not, because it's that simple, right? And Propaganda or Not just kind of came out of right field. Well, I was careful about that. And it labeled prominent websites or independent alternative websites, more obscure websites, and it labeled them fake news or conspiracy sites. And here's Craig Timberg, an editor, a journalist. He, and it's not just him, it was the senior editor at the Washington Post, Marty Baron. Oh, on Twitter, oh man, we found the culprit. Prop or Not is on the case. Well, it turns out they didn't know their methodology. They don't know who they are. It's an anonymous group of people. We can't find out where they're funded. And here's the Washington Post holding it up as the gold standard of information integrity. Well, a few days later, some of the threats and lawsuits started pouring in, like Naked Capitalism, Counterpunch, you know, websites that have a partisan agenda but are clearly not in the business of fake news. And a lot of the sites that were listed as fake news are independent journalistic outlets that we've had in our books over the years. And we know that they've been fact-checked and vetted, and we know they're actual news sites. So this is actually a thinly disguised attempt for dinosaur media, the Washington Post, to attack online new rivals that people can now click and see and lump them all in an obfuscation, right? A big pool of obfuscation that we can put obvious sites that are fake that say so right on their about page. We can pretend it's somehow the same as The Onion or satire, and then we can just lump in a few anti-establishment real journalism sites and throw them all in the trash together. Well, the Washington Post gradually had to retract their statements. Here's their retraction. The Washington Post on November 24 published a story on the work of four sets of researchers who have examined what they say are Russian propaganda efforts to undermine American democracy and interests. So Jeffrey St. Clair at Counterpunch is now like a Russian spy? Again, the absurdity is, just on the face of it, is pretty astounding. And his quips and jokes about it online were quite timely and funny.
One of them was Proper Not, a group that insists on public anonymity, which issued a report identifying more than 200 websites that, in its view, wittingly or unwittingly published or echoed Russian propaganda. A number of those sites have objected to being included on Proper Not's list, and some of the sites, as well as others not on the list, have publicly challenged the group's methodology and conclusions. The Post, which did not name any of the sites, does not itself vouch for the validity of Proper Not's findings regarding any individual media outlet, nor did the article purport to do so. Since publication of the Post story, Proper Not has removed some of the sites from its lists. But remember, I just told you that Marty Baron, the senior editor at the Washington Post, thumbed up, cheer-led, and stood right behind this publication highlighting Proper Not. So this retraction is an alternative fact. To a talk that I recently gave at Sonoma State University for Social Justice Week on critical media literacy education as the antidote to fighting so-called fake news, propaganda, and censorship in a world of alternative facts. And of course, it's been called a post-truth world, which was Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year last year. After this break, we'll continue that talk. Stay with us. Speaking of fake news, once the fake news kind of meme was running through the corporate press and political parties were using it to blame for the loss of the election of Hillary Clinton, now it's all this morass of Trump and Putin all the time. And if you want a menage a trois, throw in Julian Assange. And somehow that's sort of this explanation for what's going on, even though they have provided no evidence that the Russians actually hacked the election. Not zero evidence has been made public about that issue. But this is where the fake news meme is running as a weapon. Fake news is now a weaponized meme, and it's now weaponized language. But you know the problem with that kind of language is that eventually it gets off leash. And now President Donald Trump took that term and said, hey, we're okay. The Washington Post can run this shadowy website, Proper Not, that calls sources fake news without providing any evidence. Because they apparently disagree with what's going on. And the Democratic establishment apparently thinks things that they don't like can be called fake news. So what does Donald Trump do? He does what he does best, right? He turns it into an infotainment cluster, you know what? And he screams over the podium at Jim Acosta from CNN, and he says, you're fake news. And then they proceed to label journalists that they don't want to talk to as fake news. So this is this weaponization of the term that gets off leash, and now what are you going to do? Now, basically, the term fake news, which basically, in our definitions, going back through the 20th century, it's propaganda. Disinformation is purposefully erroneous information that's put out to deceive the public. Misinformation is erroneous information, but it may be mistaken. Now, both can have not great results in terms of having an informed electorate. But fake news is something now that we really need to trace back. We need to go and we need to take a look at what this term really is about. You know, George Lakoff, the linguist from Berkeley, actually did a piece on this, and he said, you know, the real kind of conundrum here is like an Orwellian doublespeak. When you put the word fake in front of something, like fake gun, it totally changes what's going on with that. Fake news, those are lies. They're falsehoods. So at the root of that, again, is this epistemological problem of discerning between fact or fiction. What's true? What's false?
Well, let's take a walk back historically, and let's take a little bit of a look at some of this real problem of fake news. Oh, by the way, real quick, back to the Washington Post. The Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan in the style page, she wrote later in early January after 2016, she wrote, "It's time to retire the term fake news." And I said, well, how fitting that the Washington Post that helps catapult it into the lexicon also gets to retire it after it gets off leash and is used against them. And remember that this is the same Washington Post that ran a story about how the Russians allegedly hacked a power grid in Vermont, which never happened. They never vetted it. They never fact-checked it. In other words, if you had a student writing for the Sonoma State Star and they ran a story like that, they would flunk. They'd get an F. Because they didn't fact check, they didn't ask for corroborating information, they did nothing. They just ran with it. In other words, they're publishing fake news. Here's another one of those bookmark footnotes. Let's remember also what the Washington Post is. Who bought the Washington Post a few years ago? Amazon's Jeff Bezos. About 3 months after Bezos bought the Post, he got a $600 million contract from the CIA. So just going back through history, let's think about the role of the CIA in media manipulation. Whether you want to go back to Carl Bernstein in the 1977 Rolling Stone, go back to Frank Wisner, go back to the Mighty Wurlitzer, go back to Chapter 6 of Censor 2017 that looks at an entire history of CIA media manipulation, particularly through the Washington Post and the New York Times. So the rhetorical question to you, using the parlance of our day, fake news. Is that fake news too? Was it fake news when Judith Miller wrote about weapons of mass destruction in the New York Times for weeks and months on end? Was it fake news when Lyndon Johnson pushed the press to cover the bogus Gulf of Tonkin incident that didn't take place, that sparked a massive war that killed over 3 million Vietnamese? So, yes, let's look at fake news. Let's really look at that. And I'm all in favor of retiring that term, by the way. But more importantly, let's retire the practice. Well, let's see. The history. This will be brief. As someone that's an historian by trade, that's nearly impossible, but I'll make an effort. Let's go back to the era of yellow journalism in the early 20th century. Sensationalist journalism. It was ironically at the height of the muckraking era that we saw the rise of yellow journalism that kind of grabbed onto the coattails of many of the early muckrakers when McClure's and a lot of the magazines and papers figured out these stories about unmasking corruption, they sell. People like that. And in the so-called progressive era, a lot of people in the United States used the information from these in-depth reports to reform the political system. So journalism had a real root purpose. In fact, Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored, wrote a book called Muckrakers of the 20th Century that looks at 21 of the key muckrakers in the 20th century, and he called it Stories That Changed America. That's a very significant history. But rivaling that were these people that were just on hire, and they were like, look, we can pump out these stories really fast and grab the eyeballs, and people will really buy these papers because they want to hear this corruption and this lascivious business and on and on. Well, what happened is the stories got sloppier and sloppier, and muckrakers had a real challenge in terms of doing their actual job, sort of in the din or the noise of that era's junk food news. But we know that there have always been these issues. Now, I'm going to kick it up a notch into the period of World War I, referred to as the Great War at that time because they weren't cynical enough to call it World War I when it was happening, right? That would be cynical, right? But wait till next time. It'll be bigger. It'll be worse. We'll call it World War II. But in the Great War, there was a real problem that was going on in the United States. And the problem was a political problem, and the American public did not want to enter that war. They were opposed to that war. Woodrow Wilson ran in 1960. A re-election campaign based on he kept us out of war. So Wilson purposely campaigned on the popular notion that the United States would not officially enter this war. Except Wilson had a democracy problem. Even though a majority of people did not want to go into the war, Wilson's backers, the banks and the munitions industry, were already in it. And they were kind of tugging and pulling him and saying, what do you mean you're not going to get into this full-blown? There's money to be made. Well, that's when Wilson helped create the Committee on Public Information, which was the first official government propaganda agency. And he populated it with people like George Creel, who was also called the Creel Commission. And George Creel brought in people like Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who used many of his uncle's ideas about how to manipulate people by appealing to their emotions and feelings as a way of trying to manipulate the entire public. In other words, Bernays said, you know, if you can manipulate one or two people, why can't you manipulate a bunch of people? And so the Creel Commission's job was to gradually convince the American public not only that the war in Europe was important and based on threats to U.S. interests, but that it was in fact of dire consequence that the U.S. get involved to help end it. And then this is when the propaganda campaign began, that the war was called the War to End All Wars. How's that working for us? The War to Make the World Safe for Democracy. How's that working for us? Well, these are powerful slogans when wrapped in nationalism, patriotism, jingoism, fear. They start to work out. So the Creel Commission actually brought in about 75,000 volunteers. 75,000. That traveled the country. This is before commercial radio. It's obviously before the phones and internets and TVs and all the jazz, right? So there's newspapers, there's public halls, there's movie theaters, and wow, were they popular. Silent movies don't have the talkies till 1927 or 8, but they were very popular, especially in the cities where a lot of growing populations. Right? And so these folks targeted city hall, they targeted churches, town squares, and movies. And these characters called themselves Four-Minute-Men. Minutemen, the typical person living in the United States who had any U.S. history at all, says, Minutemen, back to the revolution. We can be ready to defend the country in a minute's notice. Well, by the 20th century, it took 4 minutes. They had more to do, I guess. But they were still called Four-Minute-Men. But why did they call them Four-Minute-Men? How long did it take to change a movie reel in a theater? About 4 minutes. So these people would parade in front of the audience between films and say, we've got a big issue going on here that you need to start taking more seriously. The Germans are ripping the arms off of Belgian babies and can invade Red Bank, New Jersey in 3 weeks. Those were alternative facts. Those were falsehoods. But they were able to whip up enough fear and concern in the public over a year, 6 months to a year period, that the Committee on Public Information was able to sway public opinion, and then Wilson had the numbers he needed to not just take the country to war, but to go headlong into it. Pass the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act that made it a crime to criticize the war effort, and pass the Conscription Act to force people to serve. And over 1 million people then signed it. Eugene Debs, the Socialist Party leader, was thrown in prison for 10 years. For speaking out against the war, trying to convince workers that this was not their war, that this was a banker's war. And he was sent to prison for 10 years. He was pardoned, strangely enough, by the Republican Warren Harding just after, but nevertheless was jailed for that. And Debs was a fairly well-known person at the time. He ran for president 6 times, once from prison, getting 1 million votes. Let me just give you a real quick look. This kind of distills what Edward Bernays was doing. And after what they did in World War I, Bernays wrote a book in 1928 called, literally, Propaganda. And Edward Bernays lived a long time. He was 101, I believe, when he died. And he was one of the masterminds behind so many commercial campaigns for advertising, as well as coup d'etats and government overthrows. He had a long career in propaganda. After World War I, one of his biggest claims to fame was the Torches of Freedom campaign. That was tying into the women's right to vote, women's suffrage. And then now the cigarette companies are saying, like, hey, what would happen if women actually could smoke in public and it wasn't seen like a bad thing? We could be selling twice as many cigarettes. So Bernays wrapped it up. Torches of freedom. You're expressing your individuality and getting cancer at the same time. But don't worry about that. You're free. And it was a very, very, very popular campaign. Well, here in a nutshell is what Bernays says in 1928. Doesn't matter whether you're selling cigarettes or war. The approach is the same. And this is where we're ripping on fake news and propaganda. Bernays said that, quote, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Rewind that. The conscious and intelligent manipulation, meaning on purpose, is an important element in democratic society, manipulating the masses. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. Sounds like the deep state. We are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested largely by people we have never heard of. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they're to live together as a smoothly functioning society. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. He is arguing that propaganda is the necessary tool for population control in modern industrial democracies. Information control, not press freedom. Information control from elites who need to manipulate the bewildered herd as you. Because, as Hamilton would say, you're too stupid and ignorant. The elites need to govern you and help you, and you'll all be happier for it. Well, the condescension dripping from that kind of sensibility is hard to miss. And it's important to note that propaganda does go on to be kind of a dirty word. When we talk about propaganda nowadays, we see it as a problem. And of course, it's Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis and others that helped make it a dirty word, but who was the intellectual mentor of Goebbels and the Nazis' propaganda machine? Edward Bernays. Admittedly so, the Nazis bragged about the brilliance of the American propagandists. Hitler even wrote about it in Mein Kampf, saying, we get a chance to do that, we're going to whip up some kind of really cool propaganda campaign, too. And boy, did they ever. And of course, after this is why propaganda is something that the others do. In the United States, we just report the news. And if you go to other countries, their propaganda is called the news, too, and everything we do is called propaganda. So notice how that just goes round and round and round. Well, I'll give you another example. Who today would be maybe one of these unseen people behind the scenes kind of helping sway public opinion by what they choose to report or show? You'd be surprised to know that I've got several answers and examples for that. Here's one. The whole Trump phenomenon as a campaign, consumers, of course, were captivated by Trump's outrageous behavior. In fact, Les Moonves, the chairman of the board, president, and CEO of CBS, back where Dan Rather used to be, Walter Cronkite. Remember Walter Cronkite? He was actually a fan of Project Censored. We've come a long way since Walt, of course. Les Moonves admitted that Trump coverage led to increased profits. And he noted, while speaking at a tech conference in San Francisco in the summer of 2016, quote, I've never seen anything like this. This is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry. It's a terrible thing to say. Bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. In fact, former CBS anchorman Dan Rather warned that Trump and the media act as business partners. The corporate media's obsession with the Donald helped change the U.S. democratic process to an unholy hybrid of keeping up with the Kardashians and American Idol. In fact, 75% of Americans agreed that the corporate media covered Trump too often. Yet they kept doing it anyway. Lots more examples like that, but that kind of really helps bring us up to the present when we talk about propaganda. And in fact, the propaganda that Edward Bernays talked about, he used very specific terms. Some of you may remember terms that came out of the early 20th century industrial America, like Taylorism, the infatuation with measuring down to the minute metric to maximize efficiency and industrial production, kind of like we do that now with testing in schools, pedagogical Taylorism. But that's another topic we're not talking about right now. But that is part of the propaganda. You students know if it's not on the test, it's not important. Okay, well, who is controlling the tests? Oh, some of the corporations that publish the same textbooks. Who lobby in Sacramento and D.C. to help create education code? Propaganda has all kinds of outlets, doesn't it? Part of this propaganda included terms like manufacturing consent or engineering opinion. Some of you may have come in early and you saw we were playing the Conspiracy Theory Schoolhouse Rock video, and I also played a recent video with Amy Goodman talking about Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's propaganda model and media filters. Chomsky and Herman in 1988 wrote a book called Manufacturing Consent. riffing on Bernays, but instead of engineering opinion or manufacturing consent as the way to govern modern industrial democracies, Chomsky and Herman said this is the key campaign of deception and controlling the public mind. So they criticized the influences, and they traced five of them: ownership of the media, advertisers, where the media owners get their profits selling your eyeballs to them, sourcing, the reliance on only official sources to control the narrative, frame and marginalize dissent or other unpopular ideas, flack or feedback, and the last was ideological bias, fear, anti-communism in the Cold War, anti-terrorism post 9/11, Russiaphobia now. So they put their fingers on these five things, and Michael Peretti, for the 20th anniversary of Project Censored, wrote an essay on mass media manipulation that talked about nine features that are used to skew news, like framing and follow-up avoidance, like omission or sliding of content, attacking, labeling, these kinds of things. So we know that there are things we can put in the critical media literacy toolbox, there's that term again, that help us become more discerning, more intelligent consumers of information. That's the antidote to fake news and propaganda. Not censorship, not blacklisting, not proper not, not Snopes, but critical media literacy education, where you are in the driver's seat of your own mind. Remember Emma Goldman? Anarchist feminist, early 20th century, before she was deported on the Soviet Ark because she was too radical in Wilson's propagandized America, said the most unpardonable sin in society is independence of thought. Well, what democracy needs to thrive are a lot more sinners. And what we've been doing for 40 years at Project Censored is we've been promoting critical media literacy education as the antidote to propaganda. Fake news is propaganda. The fact that it's dressed up and with new memes and new examples doesn't change the fact that this has been going on for a very long time. So this is also why, when we've been giving a lot of these talks, that's one of the first things we say. Is we say, well, this has been going on for a long time. There's nothing really new about these things.
Listening to the Project Censored show, I'm Mickey Huff. On today's show, we're listening to critical media literacy education as the antidote to fake news, propaganda, and censorship in a post-truth world. After this break, we'll continue that talk. Stay with us.
Solutions. I just gave you what I thought ours is, but let me go back and be specific about some of the solutions that are going on and why I don't think they're working. Snopes and PolitiFact are noble if they get people thinking critically and they can be transparently sourced and they get people down the road of thinking more independently and then doing more and more research. That's certainly a good thing and it's helpful. But we have to remember that these places also have agendas, and they also have funding, and they also have biases. And I have had teams of students that work every semester on finding Snopes and PolitiFact stories that are distorted or skewed or spun or false themselves. So this isn't just the easy out. This is why we keep going back to critical media literacy education. We also have seen, we've seen other solutions, right? We've seen other attempts to fix the problem. We already talked about those, the lists. So we have the fact checkers, limited. You can never scale to the problem. You'd have to hire millions of people to fact check round the clock all the sites, all the social media. I mean, it's just, again, a wash in a sea of information. Blacklists. Well, we already talked about proper not. There were a couple of professors, Melissa Zimdars, Katie Starbird. They started trying to come up with metrics to rate news sources, but they use these labels like fake news or conspiracy site. Big problem with conspiracy is a terminology, and if you don't know about it, you can take Peter Phillips' Sociology of Conspiracy class here. He teaches it every spring. Conspiracy theory was a weaponized term that came out of the CIA in the 1960s after the JFK assassination and the Warren Commission report. You can go back and read the memo 1035-960 that purposely calls attention to the term and requests that Mockingbird journalists do everything in their power to ignore any academic books that criticize the problems of the Warren Commission report. And if you can't ignore the books and can't not review the books, then you can attack the authors by calling them paranoid or conspiracy theorists. So anybody that walks around today and uses the term conspiracy theory to discredit somebody, let's just stop that. Let's retire that term, too. There may be conspiracy theories that aren't true or are fake news, but there are also plenty of conspiracies that are very real and true, based on evidence. How do we determine whether or not that a certain conspiracy is real or true? Well, we have to look at the facts. We have to go through the thought process. So blacklisting is also an old tactic, but it also leaves us needing and wanting more. Blacklisting tries to shut down debate, and what we're saying at Project Censored and our joint organizations that we work with, like the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, with other media literacy organizations, we think that we need debate. Debate is part of the solution. Having different perspectives and verifying facts, that's all part of the solution. Blacklisting and labeling and attacking shuts that down. Okay, how about this one? You knew that there were going to be proposed laws about all this stuff, right? You knew that was coming. Here's one. California Assembly Member Ed Chow. And this is our friend Dave Moss from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, rightfully tearing apart this horrible idea. Ed Chow proposed a bill to ban fake news. It was AB 1104. Anybody hear about that? It is unlawful for a person to knowingly and willingly make, publish, or circulate on an internet website or cause to be made, published, or circulated in any writing posted on an internet website a false or deceptive statement designed to influence the vote on either of the following: any issue submitted to the voters in an election, any candidate for election to public office. Any problems with that? Who's going to figure this out? Publish or circulate on an internet website? That's like a student paper gets turned in and they cite a source and they're just like, I found it in the library. That's a big place. You're going to troll the entire internet. I mean, again, it's an absolute unconstitutional attempt to shut down free speech and expression. And by the way, Chow's proposal was so roundly savaged on said internet that he actually withdrew the bill. So that was good. But we certainly at least should be noticing that there are concerted efforts being made to literally legislate this kind of stuff. And that's probably not something we want. See if this sounds familiar. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. We can stop there. So legislating this kind of issue is not going to solve the problem either. And of course, I've already talked a little bit about some of the history of propaganda and why it's a challenge and a problem. But that's also why I want to conclude with a reiteration of our solution. And I firmly believe that the solution to the so-called fake news crisis we face is more critical media literacy education. I say it over and over again because in the United States there is no K-12 program mandated to teach children critical media literacy skills. Does that mean some teachers don't do it? There's some teachers that do it, right? But it's a luck of the draw. Or unluck of the draw, you get me, right? And you're like, oh, this guy, that's all he's talking about. There's reasons for that. There's no college requirement. There's no GE requirement. Now, some will say, oh, it's critical thinking. Yeah, but it's not always focused on media, news media, entertainment media. It's not always focused there. And I say this because there are numerous countries around the world, throughout Asia, throughout Europe in particular, that have long made media literacy part of their social educational fabric. But here, well, that would be counterproductive to the ruling establishment manufacturing of consensus. Now, wouldn't it? We don't want a whole bunch of independent thinkers running around.
That'd be awfully hard to corral, kind of like herding cats. We need people to watch the news when it's owned by six corporations. And we need those six corporations to control 90% of what you hear and read and see. And we need to attack and label and create blacklists and censor and inundate people with obfuscating language about fake news. Because otherwise, people might start to figure things out. And that's sort of the silver lining of the great catastrophe of the last year, is that people are saying, wait a minute, I didn't understand this, and why was the news not asking these questions? And we've got a whole chorus of mea culpas coming from the corporate media. We should have asked tougher questions. We should have been there. We failed. And now, get these hypocrites. You go and look at the Washington Post or the New York Times, I get this stuff coming into my inbox all the time, because I read it all the time. And they're actually riffing. They're now running advertisement campaigns about how they're gonna fix everything because they're all about reporting the truth. At least several times a week I get an email from the New York Times subscription people saying, you've come to trust the Times to tell you the truth. And again, the first thing that comes to my mind every time is Judith Miller and the 1.5 million dead Iraqis that spun from that lie and the 5 million refugees that came out of that war. That's still going on. And by the way, that reminds me of the AP running alternative facts about how, quote, only 87,000 people died in Iraq. And even at the time they were claiming that, the number was already up to over 1 million. So these fake news, propaganda, disinformation, these have consequences. And if it's not just the outcome of a particular election per se, right, that there have been studies showing like fake news didn't really cause that. Well, not fake news in the sense that a 19-year-old Macedonian kid is pumping out fake news for ad money on Facebook or Google, but let's call it by its right name, propaganda. Propaganda was thick all during the election season. And that is what is persuading people one way or another. And guess what? There's even a great disappointment emerging from some of the Trump supporters and voters. Right? When it comes time to change tax code, or it was time to repeal Obamacare, right? And of course, we saw a bunch of people saying, like, I like the Affordable Care Act, but I'm not against Obamacare. That's the product of a propaganda system. Those are the same things, of course. But now, all of a sudden, these people are saying, like, he's going to take away the health care, right? And you're just like, well, why did you vote for it? We didn't know. Okay, so this is not a moment to point and say, you're stupid. This is a point to say, we have a problem here of establishing information integrity. Fortunately, even though we have our, see our little definitions up here, fortunately, we have people that establish information integrity checklists, like librarians. This is why education is part of the solution here. If you can teach people how to check the veracity of sources and claims, this is just 2 pages long, and ask basic critical questions. This is on our Global Critical Media Literacy website, which, by the way, we started 2 years ago. I helped co-author this, the Global Critical Media Literacy Project Educators Resource Guide. It's online at gcml.org for free. And it goes through all the kind of assignments we use at Project Censored that our friends at ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education K-12 use, the graduate program we work with at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut on media literacy and digital culture, the only one of its kind in the country that specializes in critical media literacy education and social justice movements for Social Justice Week. You know, by the way, a lot of the stories that were propagandized and marginalized out of the frame of the election cycle were social justice stories. Stories of Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers, Standing Rock, the Water Protectors. Those are social justice stories. Notice how they either don't get covered or their coverage is greatly skewed in the corporate press. That's not an accident. That's, again, all part of the paradigm of fake news. So we have solutions. In fact, we have even folks like our friends at Tribeworthy.com that just made this platform in the last 6 weeks. It is like a Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes for building trust among news sources. It's called Crowd Contested Media. Now, like Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes, it doesn't give you the be-all, end-all, but you can't really go to a restaurant anymore these days without hearing people talk about a Yelp review. You go and try to watch any movie on iTunes or Netflix rates or whatever, and the Rotten Tomatoes thing is embedded right in it. Because people have grown to trust each other when saying, why did I like this, or why did I not like this, or what was good about this, or what was not good about that? So they've created a platform that uses critical media literacy skills and analysis for people to start to judge or rate news sources the same kind of way you'd rate these other things. Of course, it's new and it needs a lot of users, but these are folks from the allegedly apathetic millennial generation. Remember how the millennials were also blamed for the election outcome, right? I was like, gee, that's strange. I seem to remember a lot of enthusiasm among millennials until the Democratic convention. And then there was a lot of young people kind of saying, like, what happened? How could this guy be attracting 30,000 people in every city he goes to and we never even see this other person? And these leaked emails show that they were rigging a system. How can this happen? Well, how it can happen is propaganda. How it can happen is elite control of our political system and media. And the antidote to that is not just media democracy in action, it's people getting access to accurate information because they can think critically and independently on their own, and then they can go and share that information. And instead of sharing likes and clicks and fake news on Facebook or Twitter, you can actually start sending things to people that are vetted, and that are factual, and that are accurate, and that matter. You can be an aggregator of falsehood, you can be an aggregator of truth. That's a choice. And if you are a critical thinker, and if you have critical thinking skills based on critical media literacy education, you are the solution to these problems. The time for outsourcing these problems, whether it be legal, corporate, whether we be asking the social media platforms to fix this for us, no. We don't need to ask. We can fix it on our own. And another way we can do it journalistically is by supporting independent journalism and by being the media ourselves. And there's a lot of power that we have as people in this society to change things. We have to be committed to changing them. We have to be informed and aware about what needs changed. But I would like to close with a fantastic quote from over 20 years ago from the founder of Project Censored, Carl Jensen. Jensen wrote, "Since we will all benefit from a more responsible media, we all really should help bring it about. To do this, the corporate media owners should start to earn their unique First Amendment privileges. Editors should rethink their news judgment. Journalists should persevere in going after the hard stories. Journalism professors should emphasize ethics and critical analysis and turn out more muckrakers and fewer buckrakers. The judicial system should defend the freedom of the press provision of the First Amendment with far more rigor, and the public should show the media it is more concerned with the high crimes and misdemeanors of its political and corporate leaders than it is with the crimes and gossip of celebrities. The effort will be well worth it." I couldn't agree more, and I think now more than ever, the effort is well worth it. Thank you very much.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers of the program, while Anthony Fest is our producer. Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III are co-hosts, as is Desiree McSwain. Our intern is Alicia Farrardo. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. All of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. To learn more about the show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Prepared about criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and your policy.
Be sure to catch Apex Express on KPFA. Apex Express is a weekly program following news and cultural events throughout Asia and the Pacific Islands. Find out about issues affecting Asian American and Pacific Islander communities locally and globally. Get on board the Apex Express Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. on KPFA.
So, Chris.
Happy New Year, Phyllis.
I know, it's around the corner.
I can't wait for this.
I know, but there's a lot of things on my list. You know, I typically have a bag full of all those requests for money, of all those good causes. And then as the new year approaches, we go through the list of requests and we put them in the yes, no, and maybe pile.
Oh.
Yeah. So KPFA is in the yes pile. Let us
Well, that's good.
Yes. In the meantime, you have to make your tax-deductible contribution before New Year's. Time is wasting. KPFA, help out.
And you could probably go online and find all of the gifts that we had for our recently concluded fund drive. A little short, but that's another reason why this end-of-the-year gift would be so welcome. And we're asking you to go online to kpfa.org. And we thank you for all the support that you have already given us and for the support that you are going to be giving us.
Happy New Year.
Yay!